Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you with us today. You know, we've had a really good gardening summer, I think, in most of the state. Now it's time to start thinking about what we need to do in the cooler months. And to help us out, Diana Offuth is back with us. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County, also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. And you may have some questions for her. I hope you do. I hope you'll join in. Maybe the recent rains affected your garden. Maybe you have some questions about getting it ready for fall. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. It's called The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Diana, thank you for joining us. Great. Well, let's see. Maybe I better turn on your microphone. Great to have you. Great to have you join us.
Hi, Larry.
Oh,
thanks for having me. It's always great to be here.
Wonderful to hear your voice. The state has had a lot of heavy rains recently. Bad effects on gardens?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, every year we get to talk about the weather, and we get to blame all of our problems on the weather, no matter what it is. And, you know, overall, I think we've had a good growing season, but especially like in the northwest part of the state, they've gotten hit with major, major rainfalls. And we have, too, here in Pierce, Polk, St. Croix County, Eau Claire area, where, you know, we've had 3-inch rains, and then a week later, another 3-inch rain. And you know, we haven't had to water or irrigate,
no.
But the fungi are really happy.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of different fungal diseases going on. We have jungles out there where vegetable gardens, tomato plants, and vine crops, because of the growing season, they're just monstrous, and people are like having to slash things back to get in their garden. I actually have a squash in my garden. I grew this year. It was a Seed Savers. I don't even remember what it was, but it was a packet of seeds I got from Seed Savers somehow I got my hands on, and it was old. It was like 3 years old, and I thought, oh, I'll plant it and just see what it's like, because it was some variety I hadn't ever really heard of. And I'm actually kind of afraid to stand still in my garden for fear that the vine will grab my ankles and pull me down. It's grown so fast. The lines of that squash plant are probably up to 40 feet long.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and I don't know that they would normally get that long if it weren't for all of this rain that we've had, but it's just taken over everything. And I've had lots of people say similar things, that their plants are just monstrous, large plants this year. And of course, the weeds are, too.
Yeah, they absolutely are. I'm just thinking about my own. I've got a cherry tomato plant in a straw bale, kind of right next to the back door. And this year, I can hardly get up the steps.
Really?
The plant is enormous. I have never had a tomato plant that big.
And even with a straw bale, even if it rains, that dries out relatively quickly then because of the sides being exposed and that. So you wouldn't think that it's only because of rains that you have such a large plant this year. So it must also just be the right combination of temperatures and moisture at the right time. But people have all been reporting monstrous plants this year.
You mentioned a few problems, and Paul in Lafayette County emailed in with a question. He says, we have had a very good year with tomatoes, great tomato yield, but we have a lot of them with small black spots on them. The spots seem to be only skim deep, so we just cut them out. Do you have any idea what causes the spots and what we can do next year to eliminate the problem? Doesn't sound quite like blossom end rot, but
no, not if they're small and if they're randomly all over the place. But there are a couple other fungal things. Anthracnose will actually do that, where you'll get kind of a spot and then it'll get like a little bit of a sunken area. And if you get it quick enough, you can cut that spot out, but eventually it will eat its way in through the whole plant. But again, we have a lot of fungal things going on, so I think it would be pretty hard to find anything without a spot on it by this time of year. So really, as far as like next year goes, we probably won't have as much rain, although we said that last year, and because last year we had quite a bit of rain, too. But if, the key for any of these fungal things is try to keep the fruits and the leaves dry as much as possible. So if you do have to water, water the soil, not the plants. With this year, with the rain so constant, obviously there's nothing we can do short of putting an umbrella over the plants. But even with the humidity, that's going to encourage fungal diseases. So chances are you won't really have a problem in a normal year when we don't get so much rain, but otherwise the tried and true cultural things that we always talk about for tomatoes and all of their fungal diseases are space the plants so there's lots of good air circulation, purchase or plant resistant varieties, prune up the lower branches so you get good air circulation, mulch around them so you don't get splashing from the soil, and then water the soil, not the plants themselves, so that, because those fungal spores, when they land on those tomatoes, need it to be moisture there, whether it's high humidity or actual wetness, in order for those spores to germinate and take hold. And if it's dry, the spores just die and don't take hold.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I think when I get home tonight, I've got to go back through my whole bed of tomatoes, because they're all very large, and I noticed this morning as I walked out the door, oh, there's a few more ripe ones that I didn't see before. It's also turned into a little mosquito habitat. So.
Oh, sure. Lots of hiding places for those mosquitoes. But once those tomatoes start ripening, they really come on gangbusters. So you got to have the perpetual pot of spaghetti sauce boiling on the stove. And
there you go.
Those cherry tomatoes are great if you roast them.
Yeah, I like that. I put them on the grill. I've grilled them.
Oh, sure.
And I really enjoy that as well. Well, listen, let's give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have a question or a comment, maybe a story to tell about your garden. Call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. Love to hear from you. You mentioned weeds, and of course, my straw bales, I don't have any weeds, but in my flower beds, my daylily bed for sure, I keep looking, all right, I've got to get in there, but it's this time of the year, it's hard to feel.
It is. And what happened, what happened was I was doing really good keeping up with the weeds and stuff, and then we got that week of hot, humid weather, and it's, too hot to go out into the garden, right? But the weeds love that stuff. So now they're, waist-high weeds. But, I you don't want to go out there, Larry, but, just fortify yourself with some, good chocolate and coffee or whatever, and it's really important that you get them out of there, because one weed plant can produce an enormous number of seeds. And if you, even like in your vegetable garden, if maybe it's an area that you've already harvested and the weeds have grown up and it's like, oh, I don't need to weed that anymore because they're not competing with this year's plants, those weeds can produce seeds that you're going to be pulling their children and grandchildren for years. So it's really important to, a lot of those weeds are just setting seed now. So if you can get them out of there before they disperse their seeds, you're going to thank yourself next year and the year after, because foxtail is one of my biggest weeds in my garden. One foxtail plant can produce 4,000 seeds.
Oh.
And about 3% of those seeds will remain viable up to 17 years from now.
Oh, boy.
That's why we can never get ahead of the weeds.
All right, so, I promise I'll go out this weekend.
Yes, whack them down, mow them down if they haven't matured seeds yet or something. But you will thank yourself if you get them out of there before they disperse all those seeds.
All right, I'll do it.
Okay.
Kyle in Oregon has something for us. Kyle, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a couple questions about some giant pumpkins. I'm in a pumpkin growing competition, and where the two pumpkins are coming out of the ground, the leaves have kind of turned yellow and started to kind of rot. And I know it's not from not watering it enough, because I water it a ton every day for a while. And then also I got a couple of big fruits, obviously, that I want to preserve for the competition. And I just kind of wonder what I can do to help make sure that giant pumpkins make it till, well, October. I'll hang up and take your answer off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening.
So if I understood that correctly, it's where, like, the stem is coming out of the ground that's rotting?
I think you said the leaves.
The leaves. Well, if they're rotting, obviously there's fungal and bacterial things in there, but there might have been some damage to that point that got it started, like an insect feeding or wind whipped or something like that, and then the damaged tissue, secondary things move in and start rotting it. So there's a chance that there's that. There are also, again, fungal diseases with all of, he's mentioned that it's not from lack of watering. Well, with all the rain, it can be overwatering. And so we get a lot of rotting things and different organisms that move in once, if the plants are waterlogged. The concern I kind of have for him for his giant pumpkins is it takes a lot of water to grow a giant pumpkin. And most fruits will be bigger when they get more water because the cells expand more and that kind of thing. But a lot of times when we've had these really wet years, these pumpkins and squash and such don't store very well because they have a higher than normal water content. So a few years ago we had a really wet year, and all the jack-o'-lanterns were kind of rotting before Halloween came around. So my biggest concern would be getting it to that competition because these things may not store as well as they normally would. So the idea is going to be to try to get it up off the ground, maybe, so up onto a pallet or something where there's air circulation and they're not sitting on the ground, because that's where rot can happen more likely. Getting it out into, you know, keeping it in the sun so that it cures and that rind gets good and hard, trying not to let the dew settle on it and those kinds of things, so that it has a nice solid skin and certainly don't nick it or damage it. On the other hand, those giant pumpkins are weighed, and all that extra water in there, you know, might put you over the edge to the ribbon. So I would just really protect those things this year because I think they're going to be higher water content. And a lot of times when things grow fast, they don't grow as sturdy or as solid. And that happens when we have these really wet years with those pumpkins and squash and those kinds of things.
I remember Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist, bought some seeds from like the champion giant pumpkin in Minnesota a year or two ago. And he said, boy, you pay a dear price for those seeds.
You do. You do. I know. I've heard it's almost like there's a black market for them. And it's a supply and demand kind of thing. And one seed can be $10 and probably more. But it's all about those genetics and trying to get those giants. And it's incredible how big some of those things can get.
Oh, absolutely. Diana Alfuth, our guest today, UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. I'm Larry Mueller. KP Whaley, our on-air producer today here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, visiting with Diana Alfuth, a horticulture educator for Extension for Pierce County. Great to have her along. And lots of callers online, Diana. So let's go to Bob in Lancaster next. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Is it too late for fall root crops, you know, especially like carrots and or beets?
Well, carrots probably, because they actually do take a longer time to get growing. Beets can be very quick, and they can handle some coolness and frost even. So the key is to just get your packet of seeds and look at it and see how many days it takes for maturity. Where do you live? Are you in the north or the south?
Lancaster is only about 20 miles from the Illinois border.
Okay, so you've got a longer growing season going on down there. You can plant some beets. You might not get them to be as big by the time you harvest them. They might be, you know, nice, tasty little morsels, and certainly you can have the beet tops. So just look, there are different varieties of all of these things that are be shorter season or longer season, and let's see, we have September, October. You've got probably at least 60 days, so you could easily get a 55-day crop in before the ground is going to be freezing down where you are. Hopefully, of course, we never know
what the weather will bring.
You might be under 2 feet of snow, but some of those root crops, like radishes, beets, you could do, but carrots usually seem to take a little bit longer time. So, of course, carrot seeds aren't that expensive, so you could always give it a try. And what some people will do too is cover, once it starts, the ground freezes, they'll cover them with straw to keep the ground from freezing there, and then you can continue to harvest things out of the soil even after there might be some snow or cold around. So, I would definitely
give
try beets, though.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for calling. Kurt in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Larry. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you.
Thanks. So my question is, I bought some hybrid great tomato plants in the spring, and I started them inside, and then I transplanted to a pot. And They're finally coming to ripen, and they're supposed to be red grape tomatoes, and they started to go from green to orange color. So I was leaving them on there, and then this morning they actually fell off. So I assume they're ripe, but they have a look and a texture of a pepper, like almost a miniature bell pepper. Hmm. But if you cut them open, they're fleshy on the inside like a tomato. So this, I'm just curious, obviously, I don't know if I got a wrong seed or something pollinated weird, but do you have any thoughts on that?
It wouldn't be anything to do with pollination, not since you planted them anyway, because that would only affect plants that grow from the seeds.
Okay.
Next year. So depending on, there are a lot of different varieties of the grape tomatoes, and some of them are firmer, some of them are softer. There are some different shapes. Some are more pear-shaped. There's the cherry/grapeish tomato that looks like strawberries in shape. And I'm just wondering if maybe that's not the one you have that would look a little like a pepper. It's called, there's a couple of them now, I think, but they have the strawberry or berry in the name, and they actually are shaped almost like a strawberry. And but there are different varieties. And the thing is that if they're ripe, they're going to start getting a little softer. So whether they're, you know, a dark orange or a bright red, once they start getting a little softer and, like you say, falling off the stems, they are ripe. And did you taste them? Are they good?
Yeah, they're good. I actually sent some pictures in an email. If you can pull that up and look at them. But, yeah, they taste good. They taste like a tomato, but the texture isn't like a tomato that I've ever had. That's why I thought it was kind of weird.
Well, peppers and tomatoes don't cross, so you wouldn't get a hybrid half and half. It's probably just the variety. And then the other thing is, and I hate to keep blaming the weather on everything, but you could grow the same variety of tomato multiple years, and depending on the weather, you can get variations in color and texture and flavor and all of those things. So I'm sure it's a tomato. Whether it was mislabeled or not is, you know, hard to say. But as long as they taste good. The other thing I've noticed with the grape tomatoes I'm growing is they're very firm. They don't rot very quickly, so they are not as soft and juicy as slicing tomatoes are, and maybe that's just what you have going on, is it's just the variety is made to be, is developed to be more firm, and a lot of that sometimes comes with storage. They don't rot as easily or perish. They're not as perishable. So I'm sure it's a tomato. It's just, what variety it is.
That's the key.
Right.
It's my mystery tomato. I'll eat it.
Right.
I'm sorry.
I'm sure they're full of all kinds of the wonderful nutrients and all of that kind of thing. So just enjoy them.
We can't get the photo up on email, or at least I can't see it. If you want to post it on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we can take a look at it that way.
Okay, we'll do.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Let's see. You can join in, too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Bill in Argyle next.
Hi. How y'all doing?
Great. Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Now, I have an established asparagus bed, and I mean, it is, I never knew how much I really liked asparagus. Now, I have no knowledge of this. Now, the grass is taken, well, I moved into it, and it was already there, so, but the grass has taken over, and it grows through it, so how do I
get rid of the grass?
Yeah.
So this is a very common problem because an asparagus bed is perennial, and if you move there, who knows how long that bed has been there.
And I know it's been there for over 40 years.
Wow.
The lady, the previous lady told me her mother actually started it.
Okay. Well, no wonder the grass has moved in over that amount of time.
Yeah. Well, you know, the house was vacant for several years, so it just grew on its own. And it's got to be about, 60 foot long.
Oh, my goodness.
By 6 foot wide.
That's a lot of asparagus.
Yeah.
Oh, and every day I go out, get out of the car right before I go in the house, pick a few for dinner. Just go right on in.
Yeah.
But I have no knowledge of how to, and I don't want to treat it.
Yeah. Well, you have a couple of options. Obviously, you can dig the grass out, and a bed that big, that's going to, you know, you start at one end and you work on it a little bit at a time and just try to dig and pull that grass out. It's probably quack grass that's spreading by rhizomes and roots, and so it's always going to be a challenge. The other things that you can do is you can, quack grass is pretty much really hard to get rid of without an herbicide. So there are a couple options that people do with asparagus beds. One is that you can, in the spring before the asparagus starts coming up out of the ground, you can spray it with Roundup. And it will, because Roundup kills what it comes in contact with, what green tissue it comes in contact with. So before the asparagus is up and out of the ground, you can spray the grass with Roundup, and then it just goes into the grass blades, into the grass roots, and kills the grass. Okay? If you want to be even more cautious, you can try to wipe Roundup just on the grass blades. So you can, some people will use a paintbrush, or you can put on a rubber glove and then put a cloth glove over that and dip the fingers in the Roundup and wipe it on the quack grass blades.
Oh.
And therefore, it will go down into the quack grass roots. It doesn't get into the soil. It doesn't get into the asparagus. So it's not going to hurt the asparagus. Again, with a bed that big, that's going to be, you know, a tough job. The other option is to start a new bed. So if you could, you know, start at a new bed next to it, and then you could dig up some of the asparagus plants and transplant them out without obviously transplanting the quack grass, and then you can use mulches and you know, start a good program of weed control so that it doesn't get overrun that way.
Well, that's awesome. So now with it ferning up right now, when can I cut that out?
You really want it to go brown or yellow on its own. So if it's going yellow, that means they're basically have done all the photosynthesis, restoring the energy to the root system. And once it starts to senesce or turn yellow on its own, you can cut them off then.
Okay. And then if I cut that down and mow it down, would applying mulch right now help it at all?
It could, but if you have quack grass in there, that quack grass is going to grow through that mulch just as easy as anything.
Like everything else.
Yeah, I have seen quack grass grow through blacktop. So,
oh, wow.
So mulch is not going to smother quack grass, whereas it would smother or prevent some other weeds. But if it's quack grass in there, mulching's probably not going to get you much.
And if it's a beautiful crop of grass, too.
I bet. Especially with all the rain.
I got a bumper crop of it, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate your call very much, and good luck with that asparagus bed. Oh, man. Dan in Madison has something for us. Dan, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I got three quick questions. One is on using borax in the soil when I plant my my beets, and how much, and is that a good idea? And the second one is what I can plant now that would winter over. For example, I like celeriac and carrots and different things, so I can make a stew in the spring. I'm thinking ahead here.
Okay.
And the third one is I get a fungus on one of my beds. I have I put some lumber around, and I have like a little raised bed. But I'm getting some fungus, and I believe it's from the leaf mulch. I don't know, but I was going to dig it out, and I just wonder how I can amend that and treat that so I get rid of that brown fungus kind of thing.
Where is the fungus growing?
Well, like, for example, I thought it was coming through forget-me-nots, these flowers that come up wild, but it grows on the leaves, okay? And it takes over, you know, the leaves. And
so the leaves turn brown and crispy?
You're right, right.
Okay.
That happened to my beans. So my bean crop was not, I didn't have a good bean crop. I'm afraid now it'll attack my my squash plants that are growing down. I have kind of like a sloping plot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that, you know, with all the rain and stuff, if things are coming down and you know,
yep,
fungus or what, you know.
So what do you think, Diana?
Okay, well, let's start with the borax for the beets. Borax is actually contains boron, which is one of the plant essential nutrients that plants need to grow. The challenge and the fear is boron can also be toxic to plants. So whether or not you should add borax or boron to your soil to grow your beets all kind of depends on how much you have in your soil to begin with. So if you've already got enough boron in your soil, which in most places in Wisconsin, soils naturally have adequate amount of boron, if you've already got enough, then adding borax isn't going to help your beets at all. Okay. On the other hand, if you add too much, it can become toxic. So borax is often touted as a control for creeping Charlie that grows in grass. And the concept is that creeping Charlie has a low tolerance for high boron levels. So you get the borax on there, you get the boron levels up high enough that it kills the creeping Charlie, but not too high that it kills the grass. But if you overapply it, you're going to kill your grass, and it's going to be a couple years before you're going to be able to get anything to grow in that soil again. So it's a scary thing to do, and it's sort of the same as far as with the beets. Now, if you had a soil test done and you can ask to have it tested for boron and you can see if you have an adequate amount in there or if it's on the high side or the low side, then you would know whether or not adding boron would help.
I had a listener once who lost her whole lawn because she applied it to her lawn for creeping Charlie control, and all the grass died.
And if you have low levels of boron, you can get some problems with beets. That's true. And therefore, adding borax will help. But unless you're having problems growing your beets and getting the symptoms of low boron levels, which would be like some black sunken areas on the roots and stuff, unless you're having symptoms like that, I probably wouldn't recommend adding borax unless you are testing your soil, because you don't want to get it overly high. Plus, you should be rotating stuff in your garden, so next year you won't have beets in that spot, but if you have high, that borax level will still be high, and then you can be causing problems on next year's crop as well. So
okay.
I can't tell you how much borax to add because it all depends on what's already in your soil.
So get a soil test. What about overwintering vegetables that will kind of overwinter and then be ready in spring?
There are some, the things that are colder, or that can handle cold. I know people have done it with things like horseradish, and obviously we've all had volunteer potato plants come up.
Onions. I've had volunteer onions.
But only if you planted those onions from plants or seeds the previous year, because onions are a biennial. So if you planted them from sets, that's their second year, so then they're not going to come back, or typically they don't anyway. But onions do that. I know people have planted spinach and some of the, like kale, some of those cold season crops, and then protected them with like a heavy layer of mulch so that in the spring, as soon as the snow's off, you can pull that mulch back and they'll start growing as that soil thaws faster than you would be able to get out there and work up the soil and plant something new. And they've already got a good root system in there, so they grow really, really quickly. So think about things that are very cold tolerant, and those are the ones that usually will be able to overwinter and get a head start for you in the springtime.
And fungus.
The fungus. So if you're getting black leaves on the plants, it's probably a foliar fungal thing. My first guess is going to be anthracnose. And there are lots of different strains of anthracnose that get a lot of different plants. It's not necessarily a soil-borne thing. Those spores could be blowing in the air, and it's just that those plants are very susceptible to it. And they, again, with the moisture that we have at the soil level, the high humidity this year especially, but any year because we're watering the soil, there's high humidity there and we get these foliar fungal things. So as far as treating the soil or something so you don't get this anymore, that's probably not really an option, but in order to know for sure, we'd have to find out exactly what fungus it is that's causing these problems. So you would have to send a sample into our disease diagnostics clinic and they can figure out exactly what organism's causing this fungus. And then you would know where the source of it is and what you could possibly do about it. But it's probably not a thing where you can, you know, treat the soil or the wood that's around that raised bed in order to eliminate it. It's there's going to be more to it than that.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Dan. I want to give Tim in Whitewater a chance to join us. Tim, hello to you.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Well, mine's more of a comment. It's to, well, a couple of the calls you had earlier. We used to, I haven't been fortunate enough to have a garden in a few years, but what we used to do is heavy mulch our carrots and parsnips with leaves, or you could probably use straw too, I suppose. But we'd heavy mulch them at the end of the year for what we didn't harvest, and you'd be able to scrape back that mulch right through the winter, and the ground was quite often still workable, and you'd be able to pull carrots and parsnips, you know, right into until you got heavy freeze. And sometimes it was thawed all year long. Of course, we're at lower levels. You know,
and things like parsnips, that coldness actually makes them sweeter, and they're actually better.
And
you can even just, like, put straw bales on top of it so you can just lift the whole bale out of the way. And anything that insulates that soil and keeps it from freezing will get you, it's kind of like a nature's root cellar, just not letting
exactly
it freeze.
Worked out very well. That's my comment.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tim. Appreciate that comment. Why not? It'd be kind of a fun thing to do, wouldn't it? Ginny in Minocqua up next. Hi, Ginny. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have had knockout roses, and they just bloom all summer, and I just have always loved them. This year, I think it's sawfly is in there, and the leaves are all just eaten away. It's like a skeleton plant. It still keeps trying to bloom for me, but I don't know what to do with it now. Online, they said to pick off the larvae, but will it winter over, or should I take it out? Or
you can leave the plant there over the winter. The thing is that even though the sawflies have really removed a lot of the leaf tissue, the green tissue that was there was doing photosynthesis and feeding the plants. And the sawflies usually eat the leaf tissue but not the buds, so there are buds there yet for next year. So what you need to just do is next year watch for the sawfly to come in and then try to treat it so that the plant doesn't get stressed again. But you really don't need to treat it any differently than you would had you not had this damage. So the plant should still survive. It's maybe a little weakened because of this damage, if all of the leaves were taken off, but But otherwise, just make sure that it doesn't get any more stress. So if we do get a fall drought here, make sure that you water it well all the way going into winter, and then just treat it as you normally would. And hopefully you won't have the sawfly next year.
Is that
the only treatment, you know, just picking them off?
Well, there are some pesticides that you can use on it as well. And active ingredients, I'd have to look that up quickly. But there are some systemic things that you would pour on the soil. It would be taken up by the roots. And then when the sawfly eat them, they die before they do more damage. And there are also the sawfly itself is a looks like a fly, and it comes and lays its eggs on there, and then it's the little larvae that do all the chewing and eating. So you can treat them when they're present with a contact or a systemic pesticide. But the key is going to be watching it next year when they show up, so that you can treat them when they show up.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Nick has this one on email. I have been wanting to start a small backyard tree nursery. From what I understand, the time for softwood cuttings is late spring, early summer. Is now still a good time to propagate hardwood cuttings? I am specifically aiming to raise white pines. If you have any pointers.
White pines. I don't know. I've never really seen pines propagated.
I haven't
from
either.
Hardwood cuttings. They are typically propagated by seed, especially because they are they're easy to do it that way. But that doesn't mean that you can't do that. So. That's one I don't know the answer to right off. We'd have to kind of look that up. I'm sure that, you probably can do some cuttings on pines, but I don't know what the timing would be, actually.
No, I'm not sure.
I'm sorry.
Either.
I'd if you send me an email, I will research that one for you, but I don't know off the top of my head.
I think isn't there a book by Michael Durr?
Oh, Michael Durr, he is the woody plants guru, yes.
I'd get my hands on that or his book. Durr, yeah. I think it's spelled, is it D?
D-I-R-R.
D-I-R-R, yeah.
Yeah. I just don't know. I'm sorry, but I'd be more than happy to figure that out for you. So if you just pop me an email.
What's your email address?
It's my name, Diana.Alfuth, A-L-F-U-T-H. @ces.uwex.edu. And if you just want to Google Pierce County UW Extension and then Staff Directory, and you'll find it
there, too.
So that's probably easier than spelling my name.
Diana Alfuth, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Diana Alfuth, for this edition of Garden Talk, taking a look at your garden during this time of the year as we get ready to go into the fall season. Questions or comments, concerns, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post a garden photo and or question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. Well, let's turn to Amy in Milwaukee next, who has a question. Amy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for having me. I'm just calling because we're getting married next fall, and my parents have a beautiful farm full of sunflowers. Unfortunately, the sunflowers kind of phase out late July, early August. And we were wondering what time they should plant next year so that they're still in bloom in October.
Oh, I can't make you any promises for your wedding. So there are several issues that go on. With sunflowers, it's not necessarily it's not like beans. You plant them later, you get them later, because they will develop and mature and flower in response to how warm it is and day length. So a lot of why they start shutting down is the lower, the fewer hours of daylight. And so even now, you know, we're starting to see some plants going yellow and soybean fields are starting to turn yellow and things. But getting them all the way to October is going to really be hard. Now, the big seeded ones, you know, the big giant sunflowers, especially are going to be hard to do that. But there are the more ornamental, the flower, the, you know, the smaller heads and that are annual flowers that you don't grow for the seeds, they will tend to bloom up until they freeze. And so you might have some of those blooms around yet come October, but it kind of goes back to what we mentioned earlier, looking at the seed packet and the days to maturity. So if you found some sunflower varieties that are 50 days or 55 days or 60 days or whatever, you can count backwards for when you should be planting them. But even so, how long they take and if they'll actually be putting on a good display of blooms at that time of year when the day length is shorter, I can't guarantee that.
Sorry, Amy.
So, but you might try, you know, you could certainly try some sunflowers and that sort of thing, but grow some other things that would be really nice and ornamental that would be around that time of year, like broomcorn. Do you know what broomcorn looks like? It's really got some really cool seed heads and stuff that can be really colorful and ornamental and look very fall-like. And then if you can get a few of the sunflowers to be blooming in there along with that, you know, you can maybe still get a really neat and unique effect, but sunflowers, I don't know. I think it's iffy, and especially depending on the weather.
All right, well, thank you. We're trying to go with, we found some Autumn Beauty and Evening Sun heirloom seeds, so we're going to try those out, hopefully. They say they bloom over a long period, so we're hopeful.
And again, it's, you know, they should say how many days it takes for them from seed to bloom, so you can do some math that way as far as planting them. And I would suggest planting multiple crops, you know, a couple weeks apart, because again, if it's a really hot year, they're going to mature faster. If it's a really cool year, they're going to mature slower. So if you can, you know, plant a couple plantings a couple weeks apart, you're hedging your bet.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Amy. Good luck with that marriage. Appreciate your call. Mary and Rubicon up next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm in the middle of making zucchini bread from my baseball bat-sized zucchini.
Oh, but that's good. Zucchini bread's great.
They're huge. I got to freeze them, actually. But my question is about my pickle plants this year. They seem to be eaten up. The leaves were all just damaged by some insect eating them. And I tried 7 dusting, and that didn't seem to do anything. And then I tried neem oil, and that really didn't help either. I'm looking out there. They're, like, totally gone now. I mean, I did get quite a few pickles out of there, but not the usual crop.
So parts of the leaves were just disappearing, but you never actually...
Oh, they're just totally damaged, all brown, eaten, you know?
Eaten, so the leaf tissue is actually gone, or just...
Yeah, now they are. Yeah, they're like... Well, now it's over anyway. It was kind of early year here for pickles.
So, but you never actually saw any insects on it?
You know, there were ants everywhere, but I didn't, you know... this year I used newspaper to lay down and then leaves over it to mulch.
Uh-huh.
And that really kept the weeds down. I mean, I couldn't believe how well that worked, but with those leaves on top, you know, it seemed to attract a lot of ants.
Okay.
Could that be?
Well, ants don't eat...
I didn't think
the leaves, but what you might have had, I'm wondering if the leaf tissue actually disappeared, or if you mentioned that they turned brown, if the leaf tissue kind of turned brown and then flaked away, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah, I think that might be a better description.
Yeah, so then we didn't have an insect.
I mean, there'd be holes in it, and then they just would keep going?
Yeah, and so if the leaf tissue, if it turns brown first and then flakes away, then we don't really have an insect eating the leaves.
Ah.
And typically, if an insect is eating the leaves and is progressing, you're going to see the insects there munching away, and it's usually a beetle or a caterpillar kind of a thing. So you probably got, there's a couple of things that you might have had. One is you could have gotten a fungal issue on there, and powdery mildew and downy mildew, and there are some other things that can cause leaves to turn brown, and then as that tissue dries, it just flakes away, so it disappears.
Okay.
The other thing, since you mentioned that you have a lot of ants, is there are, you might have had aphids on the cucumbers, plants, and if they're on the stems and they suck the juices out of the leaves and the stems, and that would kind of make them turn some brown, because aphids, their poop is called honeydew, and it's very sweet and sticky, and that will attract ants. So if you had a lot of ants around, they may have been there because there were aphids there, and the aphids could have been sucking the juices out of the plants, and that's what caused them to turn brown and the leaves to disappear and that kind of thing. So it might have been one of those two things. Cucumbers are remarkably susceptible to a lot of diseases, it seems, that bother the leaves. Like I said, powdery mildew and other things, angular leaf spot and stuff that causes them to kind of crisp up and disappear early in the year. So it may have been, again, a part of this wet year that the fungi are having such a fabulous year. And
so what do you do for it?
Well, you know, at this point, obviously,
it's too late to do much.
The things to do is to watch for any symptoms that start showing up early in the season, and then you can treat them with fungicides. You can try for powdery mildew, you can try a baking soda mixture with baking soda, a little horticultural oil and water, and you spray it on, and that can have some effect, and maybe not, you know, prevent 100% of it, but knock it back so that you get your full crop, that kind of thing. But fungicides are preventatives. They have to be on before the symptoms are out of control. It doesn't cure it. So it kind of protects the leaf so that the fungal spores can't germinate and take hold. So if you had it this year, you should be prepared for next year to have it again. You can look for varieties of pickles and cucumbers that have resistance to diseases, and that will help. And again, if we have a drier year next year, we may not have so many problems with that.
Yeah. And, you know, when do I know I've got spaghetti squash in my garden? I mean, I've got, they're huge. When do I pull them out? The leaves are still green.
Look at the stem, don't you?
There are a couple of things that you can do, and we actually have a publication on harvesting so that you can tell the different things when they're ready to harvest. There should be, and with these vine crops, there's usually a tendril that's just upstem from the fruit, and when that tendril starts to dry up and curl up, that usually means that the whether it's a watermelon or a pumpkin or a squash, is ripe. The other thing to look for is where the squash is on the ground. There's always a lighter spot. And when that turns from green to a more yellowish or orangish, or depending on the variety of the squash or pumpkin, when that starts changing color, that's usually an indication of when it's ripe. And then, like you say, once the vines start drying up or going off color, then they're usually as ripe as they're going to get as well. So there's a couple of those things. But if you just go to the our Wisconsin UW Extension Horticulture website, there is a publication on when vegetables are ripe that will give you some hints on when they should be harvested.
Good idea. That's a great idea. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks, Mary, for calling. Appreciate your call. Linda in Ashland, thank you for calling. Hold on here a second. Oh, I missed Hey, Miss Linda. Linda, hang on. Gloria in Shell Lake, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. We are having harvesting tomatoes, and it's a fairly decent harvest this year. And I have Early Girl and Viva Italia. And on the Early Girl, while the bottom portion of it is ripening like to red, the top shoulder area is staying hard and is yellow.
What's causing that?
That's not uncommon. It's usually called green shoulders or yellow shoulders. It's a syndrome. It's not really a disease that causes it, but it can be caused by excessive sunlight. So the fruit that is hanging out there in the direct sun, it can affect the top of the tomato where it's getting really hot from the sun, and then it doesn't ripen normally. That's the most common.
Can you eat that? Cut the, I mean, not the green part, but the other part?
You can, and usually the bottom part of it is tasty and juicy and ripe and just fine, but the top part of it is going to be hard and not ripe. So, so it's still edible on that bottom part, but you just...
Avoid the other part. That makes a lot of sense to me. Well, Diana Alfuth is our guest today. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Back with me, Diana Alfuth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County, teaches landscape design at UW River Falls as well. Questions, I hope you'll join us. A couple of open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Diana, we have Linda in Ashland up next. Linda, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about... when you have a popple tree in your yard and it shoots up them little shoots all over your lawn, I have that happening in a flower bed that I have. And we let one of those popple trees grow in the flower bed because our one popple tree that we do have has had quite a bit of damage and it's going to go. So now I'm wondering if I use Roundup on the other little shoots, is it going to kill that tree?
Maybe.
Yeah.
It kind of, popple trees will, a lot of those shoots are all connected to the main tree. Popple trees also reproduce by seed. They're very, very good at seed. So the question is, the tree that popped up in your flower bed, did it get there from a seed or did it get there from a root connection? If they're connected by roots and you spray one, the Roundup can theoretically go into the rest of them and kill them as well. If it went from a seed, obviously there's no connection there. So it's kind of hard to say. Now, what one thing that you could do, the one that's in your flower bed, are you planning to transplant it or are you going to leave it grow there?
It's a good spot for it. I just go.
Okay. And so how far away from it are any of these other little shoots that you'd want to spray with Roundup?
Well, the flower bed is about 5 feet long and 3 feet wide.
Okay.
And it's right on the edge of that.
Okay.
And there are other ones near it?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So they may very well be connected all through the root system. So one thing that you could consider is breaking that root connection, which would basically be taking a shovel and encircling out at the edge of the flower bed, just taking the shovel and stomping it down and trying to sever any root connections to the ones that you want to spray. And popples are pretty, I don't want to say weedy, but they're pretty hardy plants that if you were cutting roots 3 or 5 feet away from them, it'd be no different than transplanting that tree. And and that kind of thing. So if you could somehow sever the root connections to the ones that you want to spray with Roundup, that would probably, you know, help.
Could I do something like clip them off and then dub that end with tar or something to keep them from coming up, or are they just going to sprout up on the sides below it?
That usually sprouts up on the sides below it because it's basically the roots that are feeding the resprout.
Because okay. I've been hacking them off for the last few years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you continue to hack it off, like as soon as it gets a little green leaf there and stuff, you should theoretically eventually be able to kill that one off. But again, the problem is that these root systems can be so massive and they just keep shooting up from the roots. And if you hack off one enough times and it doesn't shoot up anymore, you're going to get another one, you know.
Pretty quick.
Right. Because the root system can just support so much.
Yeah.
Canopy and so much top stuff. So the Roundup stuff it is only going to travel so far within that root system, but how far that is, we don't know. So if you treated one that's, you know, 20 feet away, even if they're connected by root, it may not damage the one that you want to keep, but, you know, we can't be sure. And unless you can somehow sever that root system.
I'd sever. And then, you know, most of the time those roots are, what, top 4 inches or so?
Right. The majority of most trees, the majority of the roots will grow in the top 8 to 12 inches of the soil. And popples, because they are ones that, you know, can handle, like, floodwaters and things like that, they do tend to creep pretty close to the surface. And that's why they can shoot up those new trees out of there, because they don't have very far to go up.
Good luck, Linda. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Christy in Potosi has something for us. Hi, Christy.
Hi. I don't know if I'm beyond your garden expertise, but in my garden and my flower beds this year, I have lots of acorns that sprouted, and I have lots of baby oak trees, probably a couple dozen altogether. I'd kind of like to try transplanting them, and my questions are, how can I increase my chances of success, and when should I do it?
And how big are they now?
Well, they just sprouted this year, so some of them are approaching a foot tall, but, you know, some of them are much smaller, maybe 4 or 5 inches. They're babies.
Yeah. Well, I would transplant them as soon as possible because oaks are notorious for being hard to transplant.
No.
They tend to get quite a taproot, and they don't like being disturbed. So I would do it this fall. Maybe in a month or so, mid-September-ish.
Okay.
That kind of a thing. And dig as big, as deep of a hole as you can. Try to get as much of that root and keep as much soil around it as possible. And get it right back in the soil where you want them to grow as quickly as possible. Or even you could put them in pots or containers if you want to hold them, you know, to plant them where in a desired spot next year or something. And then make sure that you water them really, really well. And if you transplant them like mid-September, they'll still have probably at least 6 weeks or so of warm soil where the roots can grow yet this year, and then they can take off next year. I would not expect 100% success with them because, like I said, oaks, even when they're really little, they just don't like being transplanted very well, but it's definitely doable. And
give it a try.
Yeah.
Why not? Right. Thanks a lot for calling. Char, let's go. Ellie in Burlington up next. Hi, Ellie. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, so my husband and I recently planted cherry tree and an apple tree. And we had a ravage of Japanese beetles. And also, you know, we kind of planted them late in the season, and we're kind of hoping to get them through fall and winter. But after the Japanese beetles came through, I mean, they're looking really sad. We are wondering what we could do to kind of ensure that they'll make it through the season.
Okay. Well, it's kind of like the rose question we had earlier. There's not anything you can do, obviously, for the Japanese beetle damage and the leaf disappearance and that. Mm-hmm. The only thing you really can do is to try to eliminate any other stresses that the trees might have. So if the rain turns off and we get into drought, you want to make sure that you water, keep those trees well hydrated going into winter so that they don't have a drought stress on top of it. You want to also make sure that you do the normal winterization thing since they're young trees. Wrap the trunk, put some hardware cloth around the bottom so you don't get any rabbit or vole damage over the winter. Try to make sure that deer can't come in and nip off all the tips of the branches, because they will. and then just, you know, protect the trees just as you otherwise would. There should be buds.
Okay.
Yeah, there should be buds on those stems, on those branches that the Japanese beetles did not eat, because they don't typically eat the buds. They just eat the leaf tissue. So you should get them to leaf out just fine next year. And then if you can try to protect them from being defoliated by Japanese beetles again next year, that will help, because being newly planted trees, they need to worry about building resources, and when those leaves disappear, that's hard to do. So try to protect them at least for a couple of years until they get good, well established, and they should be able to be just fine. But that's about all you want to do. If you planted them this year, I would wait until spring to fertilize them, and then, like I said, just try to avoid any other stresses.
Awesome. Great. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks for calling. Now we go to Shar in Osseo. Hi, Shar.
Hi. I have phlox growing along my deck, and I've had them for probably 15 years, and they've always been just beautiful plants, come up really nice and green with almost a purple tinge to the leaves and stuff. Last year, before they started blooming, so about halfway through their life, the leaves started getting almost a darker green or a lighter green stripe with black spots. There's no bugs, and the leaves almost kind of start to curl a little bit, and they will bloom probably a fourth of the flowers that we've had. Any suggestions?
It's probably a fungal thing going on, and phlox are notorious for powdery mildew, but they can get some other things too, like anthracnose and that sort of a thing again. So if the leaves are kind of curling and brown, if you don't see any insects, and you should look very, very carefully, because you could have little mites on there that are sucking the juices out of the leaves that can cause curling, and look for like any little webs, because that would be like spider mites, although we wouldn't typically have that in a wet year. Spider mites like hot, dry conditions, but there could have been aphids or something that's sucking the juices out of the leaves, causing them to curl. But otherwise, it's probably something fungal. If you had it, did you say you had it last year and this year?
Yep, last year and this year.
Okay, so you might have that pathogen now in your area, and so that's why you were able, why you got it again. Although last year was pretty wet as well as this year in Osseo area. So the keys then would be to clean up the plant debris, remove all the leaves and stems and everything that's affected, get it out of there, don't let it overwinter, because if it is fungal, then those spores may be overwintering on that plant debris. So good garden cleanup this fall would be essential. And then next year, You can assume that there's still going to be spores in the area, and especially if it's a high moisture year next year, you might consider treating with a preventative fungicide, just spraying them in the spring when the new growth is coming out, and trying to prevent them from getting the fungus in the first place. Because again, fungicides are preventative. They don't cure it once the symptoms are there. And the other option, again, would be to send a sample into the disease diagnostics clinic to find out exactly what the problem is.
Okay.
But, you know, my suspicion is that it's fungal in nature. It got in there. Now you've got the spores present. Okay. And if the conditions are right, meaning we have enough, the environmental conditions, enough moisture, you're probably going to get it again.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, one thing that I've noticed, and because I've been watching when I drive around, we're in a rural area, but there's plants growing on farms that are just gorgeous, like what we used to have. They're not having the same problem I am.
Yeah, and so you might have gotten it in your garden. You might also have little different conditions. You might have less air movement, higher humidity, less sunlight. All of those little microclimate things might encourage yours to have it versus theirs.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
You know, and the ones that I've seen that look healthy, they're standing out. They're not, this, like I said, this is up next to our deck, so there probably isn't a lot of airflow from the back. And the plants that I've seen that are healthy are growing in patches, kind of freestanding in the yards.
Yeah, that's cool. That could be part of the difference.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Char. Karen in Seymour, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Hi to you and your guests. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a follow-up to something I heard on your show. I always learn really good things. You were talking about boron, and I'm always trying to look for organic alternatives because I have horses and a burrow and cats and dogs all out on the farm. And keeping the grasses down underneath, like, the horse fence or the arena fence, I'm wondering if I could use boron in those places to kill it for a considerable period of time, which would cut down on my physical labor.
Well, theoretically, I suppose you could if you put it on thick and heavy enough to make it not hospitable to the grasses. Theoretically, I don't know that it, I mean, I don't know if anyone ever having done it. The one thing that I would want to check out before I would do that, though, is if any of that would become toxic to your animals in levels. Because if they're grazing on it, the stuff that's on the edge might have really high boron levels in it. And I don't know if that would affect any of the critters that you're talking about.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's, you know, putting it on in that high levels all around a fence, if that's going to be cost prohibitive either. So that would be something else,
too. Do you have any ideas of something that I could do that, you know, wouldn't be toxic to animals that would, you know, try to cut down on, you know, mowing, pulling.
Yeah, I have a farm. I understand.
Okay.
You know, that's really hard to say. There's not like an organic herbicides. People say, oh, vinegar, but vinegar is not going to kill quackgrass roots and things like that. It's not going to be an option. So you can always mulch. You can take old hay or whatever and kind of, you know, put it under the fences so that stuff doesn't grow up under it and you've got a little bit of a border there. And the only other thing that typically gets done is using a long-use herbicide, but that is, if it's going to be long-acting, there's issues there as far as toxins and environment and that sort of a thing. So, unfortunately, I don't have much of an option other than something that's smothering it out.
Okay. I appreciate it. Love your show.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's see, is Carol in Oak Creek available here? Hi, Carol.
Yes, good morning. Say, listen, last year I started putting some perennials in my garden the first time. I bought a small Shasta daisy plant, and it took real good. And this year it looks like a forest. and it bloomed only once, and I can't find any information concerning how to cut it down or the bloom. If it comes up again, do you know anything about the Shasta daisy plant?
So you have a forest of it now, and it bloomed, and now the blooms have faded.
Correct. Yes, I cut all the blooms off, and do you know if it's going to bloom again at all?
Sometimes they do, but not always. If you cut them off early enough in the, you know, as soon as they're done blooming and we have a long season, you might get some more blooms. But they're like, you know, most perennials kind of bloom once. They're not like annuals, like a petunia or a marigold that you deadhead them and they continue to bloom. So you can get a few blooms. It's not going to be a solid blooming like you had the first time, probably. But if the season stays long enough that they can form some more blooms, they do sometimes, but it's not a for sure thing.
And then when the fall comes, do I cut them down? Because they're about 3 feet high right now.
Okay. Yes, when fall comes, you can cut them down once they start turning brown or yellow on their own. So you want them, if as long as they're green, you want them to stay out there collecting sunlight as long as possible until they kind of shut down for the winter. And then anything that's dead or dying, you can get rid of and clean up for the winter.
I was just blown away this year because the plant that I planted last year was only about, I don't know, half a foot high and maybe a half a foot wide. And now I have a daisy that's like a forest.
Well, you could divide that off and make a whole lot of friends. And this rainy weather summer has really caused things to be happy and spread a lot.
Carol, thank you for calling. Sue says on email she loves the show, by the way. Thanks, Sue. She also has a question. I planted blacktail mountain variety at the end of May. The pack says they'll be ripe in 65 to 75 days. I picked up one a couple of weeks ago and was disappointed it wasn't ripe, despite being soccer ball size. I thumped on it, sounded hollow, and there was a yellow area on the bottom, a couple of cues I thought I should use. How do you tell if a watermelon is ripe? I have five more, and they are getting bigger and bigger. What a rain-rich environment we've had. That may be part of the problem in terms of the taste, so much moisture.
It is, and when we have dry seasons, we usually have more intense flavor, especially on things like onions and garlic and that kind of thing. But when we have things that grow fast and large, because of a lot of water, it's diluted, basically, and those flavors aren't usually as strong. So as far as when a watermelon is ripe, that can get hard, especially with the different varieties that are up, because there's so many different colors of the rinds and that sort of a thing. But the things to look at, again, are there's usually a tendril. The tendril closest to the watermelon, it's just that little squiggly thing, looks like a pigtail or so on the vine. When that changes from green to brown, that's usually an indication that that melon that's nearby is ripe. So make sure that little tendril is fully brown. And then that spot on the bottom should turn from white to yellow. People get into thumping and say that, you know, it changes from a metallic ring to a hollow sound, but that's a relative thing. And I that's never worked for me. I'm sure there are experts that have that all worked out. But the biggest thing is looking for that tendril and then the change for the color on the bottom. And
there you go.
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of different varieties, so it can be hard.
Diana, it is always a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Garden Talk. Boy, we've talked about a lot of things today.
It's that time of year where there's a lot going on, and it's time to really start doing fall things, so dividing plants and transplanting, and again, with all the fungi out this year, make sure you do a lot of good cleanup of anything that was diseased so that you don't have problems in the future.
So there's quite a few things left yet that we can still do, for sure. And I'm going to take your advice and get out and weed the garden this weekend. It looks like we'll have some more rain. So in between rains, I'll be out there pulling weeds.
That is one thing. The rain makes the soil nice and soft, so those weeds pull really easily, and it's kind of gratifying to look behind you and see all those...
A pile of weeds.
Right, and open spaces where weeds once were.
Diana, thanks again.
It's always great to be here. Thanks for having me, Larry.
Diana Alfith, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. We'll have her back. Certainly, we'll do this all over again. Well, taking a look ahead, on Monday we'll talk to the author of a book titled Matchmakers of Minnow Bay. It's set mostly in Wisconsin. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.